Welcome to KG News Morning Magazine. It's November 14th of 2022. I'm your host, Christian Garibay. Coming up on today's program, Denver voters overwhelmingly passed the Waste No More ballot measure to expand curbside recycling and composting. We'll examine the logistics of how that mandate becomes a practice. And CityCast Denver host Bree Davies chats with Blackpacker founder Patricia Cameron to discuss why the camping season doesn't have to stop as winter approaches. At the bottom of the hour, we'll hear the BBC headlines and then the Hightower Lowdown. After that is Storytellers of Color with Rosanna Longo-Better and a special guest, community historian and activist Frank Archuleta. Then at 9 a.m., we'll bring you Counterspin, a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. After that, Shauna Sprouse will be in the Denver studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that is still ahead this morning, but first, these headlines with KG News' Kiara Damari.
The U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments next month in a Colorado case involving a wedding website designer from Littleton and an argument that the First Amendment protects her refusal to provide services to same-sex couples. Lori Smith, the owner of 303 Creative, says Colorado's anti-discrimination law violates her right to free expression. The conservative majority court will hear Smith's case December 5th. Colorado became the second state in the U.S. to legalize the use of psilocybin or magic mushrooms last week, Jack Armstrong reports.
Ballot Proposition 122 passed with a razor-thin margin last week, with just 51% of the vote. The ballot measure allows adults 21 and older to grow and share psychedelic mushrooms. The measure also allows the creation of state-regulated centers, which gives patients the opportunity to make an appointment and consume psilocybin in a supervised setting. Unlike cannabis in the state of Colorado, Proposition 122 does not offer the chance for retail sales of the drug. Psychedelic mushrooms are still classified federally as a Schedule I drug under the Controlled Substances Act, alongside drugs like heroin and LSD. Proponents say the hallucination-inducing substance will help those requiring alternative ways to heal from mental health problems and traumatic experiences. Colorado voters saw the benefit of regulated access to natural medicines, including psilocybin, so people with PTSD, terminal illness, depression, anxiety, and other mental health issues can heal, comments co-proponents Kevin Matthews and Veronica Lightning Horse Perez in an email statement. For KGNU, I'm Jack Armstrong.
The vote in favor of creating a library district in Boulder is leading by around 2,000 votes. Results for the measure were the lightest among all of the local ballot initiatives, with the no vote leading on election night. Boulder County Clerk and Recorder Molly Fitzpatrick says local election workers will return from the Veterans Day break today to continue processing the remaining 10,000 ballots. Denver Public Schools will open a free grocery store at Placebridge Academy in Cherry Creek to help families struggling with food insecurity, Claire Purnell reports.
About 33% of people living in Denver are food insecure, according to a study conducted by Hunger Free Colorado. Denver Public Schools' new community hub and engagement department will run the store with funding from Amazon, Aetna Insurance, and Gooder, an out-of-state nonprofit organization. DPS teachers and staff can refer families to apply for access to the store. DPS will consider the referral before meeting with the family to complete an intake with basic questions. Following this, the family can shop at the store once a week as long as they can provide documentation that they are a Denver resident. This grocery store is one of six that will kick off the three-year pilot program. For KGNU, I'm Claire Purnell.
The race for Colorado's 3rd Congressional District is still too close to call. According to the Denver Post, election workers continue to count ballots in the race for U.S. House Representative between incumbent Republican Lauren Boebert and Democrat Adam Frisch. As of Sunday night, Boebert leads ahead of Frisch with 1,122 votes. However, according to the Secretary of State, 3,000 to 6,000 ballots are left uncounted. According to the Boulder County Clerk's Office, the repeal of CU South development is losing by over 3,000 votes. This means the development of CU South will include a flood mitigation project, affordable housing, and possibly a small-scale stadium. Cool air is starting to ease in as Colorado expects a week of chilly weather. A cold front coming from Canada will chill the northern parts of Colorado, while a cutoff low in New Mexico will cool the southern parts of the state. As a result, today is a first alert weather day for the change in the temperature profile that is expected to last several days. The large impact from the cold front will not be the snow, but the stretch of much below average temperatures for this time of year. Today in Boulder, expect a high of 36 and a low of 18, with a 20% chance of snow before 4 a.m. In Denver, a high of 36 and a low of 20, with a 20% chance of snow before the early morning tomorrow. In Fort Collins, a high of 38 and a low of 15, with a light chance of snow between 8 p.m. and 2 a.m. For KGNU, I'm Kiara Damari.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Christian Garibay. America Recycles Week kicks off today and runs through November 18th. This year's Week of Awareness comes on the heels of electoral wins for a nationwide smattering of ballot initiatives on recycling. One of those successful initiatives was Denver's Ordinance 306, also known as the Waste No More measure. It will expand curbside recycling and composting in Denver from single-family residences to multifamily housing, apartment buildings, and to businesses that produce food waste. For more on the logistics of large-scale recycling, Shannon Young spoke earlier this morning with Keith Harrison, founder and CEO of the Recycling Partnership.
Start by explaining what America Recycles Week is about and what it seeks to accomplish.
America Recycles Week is really about understanding how this U.S. recycling system works. The public is interested in recycling. In fact, we know that 80% of the public really believes that recycling is an important part of protecting the environment. But we also know that they're confused. This is changing. New bills are passing, things that didn't used to be recyclable are, and we see this in this change, some public confusion. And so this week is about really grounding the importance of recycling, not just for the environment, but also for the economy.
Recycling rates have improved over the past decades. What are the contributing factors to those gains and what more needs to be done?
So when we look at what makes a successful recycling system, we see a few things. One, can people recycle? Can they do it at home? And right now we know in the greater Denver area, about 40% of single family and multifamily homes combined can recycle at home. So we need to improve that number. One, can they? The second thing we look at is, do they? So we worked in Denver a few years ago on recycling specific to can recycling. We were really interested in those aluminum beverage containers and steel soup cans. And what we found was about half of all the cans that could be recycled were. The rest were in the trash. So can people, do people? And then the third thing is about infrastructure. We know that we need a stronger U.S. infrastructure to make more things recyclable. And that really serves U.S. businesses as they turn old things into new things.
Now, Denver voters passed the Waste No More measure by nearly 70%. So there's a mandate for it. And waste management was also on the ballot in places like San Francisco and San Diego, as well as in areas of Vermont and Michigan. How significant is it to pass recycling laws via the ballot box? And how quickly can all of that infrastructure come into place once these measures come into effect?
Policy is very important to fixing the U.S. recycling system. We did a study and we understand that a $17 billion investment in the U.S. recycling system, meaning can people, do people, and is there the right infrastructure, would deliver a $30 billion return. That's an investment we can't afford not to make. So ballot initiatives like the local ones you just mentioned are super important, but they also tie up to the state level. Colorado is one of four states that have passed producer responsibility laws. That means that companies that make stuff and sell stuff in the state are responsible for making sure that the recycling system is on par to get them back. We're really interested in seeing more of those state-level initiatives tie into building a consistent recycling system across the entire country.
And that producer recycling or that producer responsibility initiative is fairly recent, and we haven't exactly seen it come into force in everyday life. Back to the question about timelines, really, how long does it take to take something from an approved measure to an actual functional system, both in producer responsibility and for expanded curbside recycling.
Right. We all want change right away. And that's what our nonprofit is all about. But there is a timeline involved. So the bill, the producer responsibility bill that Colorado passed this year, will start to take effect in 2025. And so in the meantime, as we layer in public local initiatives, like the bills that you mentioned that just passed, we're seeing a strengthening of a commitment, a resolve towards a common system. And that's a good thing.
Where are the gaps when it comes to bringing recycling rates in the U.S. up to what they are in a place like the European Union?
What are the gaps for recycling across this country? It is actually everywhere. We can't just point to one part of the country. We have to look at every city and ask questions about equitable access. Do we have equity when it comes to recyclability? So we know that multifamily housing has a lower access rate, meaning fewer opportunities to recycle than single family, for example. And so we have to look at this from an equity point of view if we're really going to make the grade, and understanding that those gaps in equity exist in every community across the country.
And there's also a degree of variance from municipality to municipality. Are you aware of any efforts to create more uniform standards that would, for example, make recycling in Denver similar to what it's like here in Boulder?
Absolutely. So policy is a great opportunity to harmonize what's recyclable. I think we've all been in that situation where we've traveled to someone else's house or we've moved and we've thought, well, wait a minute, I can recycle this at home. Why can't I here? So the reason that there are those variances is that there are 9,000 different recycling programs across the country. Recycling is a national theme, but it's delivered on the local level. And so communities do their very best to recycle as many things as possible. But that inconsistency just comes into play with the variability of 9,000 recycling programs. So as we look to policy to help level that playing field, the harmonization of what is and isn't recyclable will help. It will also help companies be held accountable for designing more things to be recyclable. We really want to see more policy that helps deliver a consistent design for recyclability and a better infrastructure to recover more things. I think the public is looking for that too. We know the public knows they want to do their part at home, but it needs to be easier, it needs to be clearer, and they need companies to do their part.
And with those 9,000 separate recycling programs in effect throughout the United States, are there any of those programs in particular that you can point to as examples of really getting it right and that could serve to be a model for some of the other municipalities who may just be kind of starting off in their recycling journey?
Well, I think Denver is a great example of building consistency of access between multiple and single family homes. We also look to Arvada, Colorado. We recently worked with them to add cart access. That means those big recycling carts to as many households as possible, because we know that the volume of the container really matters. Think of all the things you're ordering online today that you didn't used to a few years ago. You need volume. So when we look to success, we see success in every single state. Denver and Arvada are two great examples that for communities outside of Colorado to look towards.
And as we wrap up, is there anything else that you would like to add that our listeners should know?
So if you're in the public and you're thinking, wait, I just have a few questions about recycling, you know you can go to recyclingpartnership.org for questions. And if you have one tip to share across America Recycles Day, share with your neighbors that it's important to put recycling in the bin, but never bag it. Leave it loose.
Keith Harrison, founder and CEO of the Recycling Partnership, thanks for speaking with me today.
Thanks very much. Glad to do it.
For KGNU, I'm Shannon Young.
Chilly weather is headed our way this week, with temperatures forecast to dip into the single digits by the weekend. For some, That may sound like an opportunity to head out for snowy outdoor activities. Beyond skiing, snowboarding, and maybe snowshoe trekking, have you ever considered pitching a tent in the high country during the winter months? Patricia Cameron, writer and executive director of Blackpackers, thinks you should. Coming off a trip to Alaska where she camped on a glacier, the outdoor expert returns to CityCast Denver to talk with host Bree Davies about why camping in the snow can be fun.
I wanted to talk to you because the weather's finally getting colder, and I think for a lot of people this means the end to camping season, and that is not the case for you. You are a winter camper. Why? Tell me why.
Why do I winter camp? why not, though? It's just, you know, the difference in winter camping is just the gear you take. And I know, you know, cold weather can be intimidating to some folks, but there's so much to be gained from camping in the winter and, you know, testing your own merit. And then also the different wildlife that comes out in the winter. There aren't bears, hopefully. They're sleeping, so people don't have to worry about that. And it's just a lot more quiet. So you can spread some of that use that people have over the summer. And like, if you could spread it over the entire year, maybe the summer season won't be such a rush to get to spaces.
Oh, I didn't think of it that way. Like, because we've talked about this, but we've seen such an increase in people utilizing our outdoor camp, you know, places to camp. And maybe this is a great way to sort of beat the crowds a little bit.
I think so. I think if you can really enjoy winter, you won't feel that mad dash in summer. And I'm that way. Like, if I can experience camping all four seasons, and that's not to take away from summer, of course, we love summer. But another thing to imagine is fires are more likely to be able to something you have at your campsite in the winter. The fire danger is a lot less than in the summer.
So maybe you can take advantage of and enjoy some of those things about camping that have become increasingly we have to be more cautious with, for sure.
Right. Between the crowds and the fires, that's less of an issue in winter. And so that's one of the reasons I like it. And also, I just like the sound of winter. It's a different kind of silence. It's interesting.
You mentioned, too, like merit. Like, is that something that you think about when you're camping? Like the fortitude, these things that you want to accomplish maybe personally?
Right. So I don't believe that people need to have trauma-based resilience. I do think that, you know, building resilience and stepping outside of your comfort zone, not too far, not into your fear zone, but outside of your comfort zone, is a good thing for your mental health. It's a good thing for your outdoor skills and building those outdoor skills. And so for me, going out in the winter where it's a little bit more difficult, it's a good way for me to kind of expand upon my outdoor skills and gain that confidence that the outdoors give so many people. And that's part of the reason why they go out, you know?
Sure, sure. So where would be some of your favorite spots to winter camp in Colorado?
I wrote about this for the Denver Post years back. I did a winter camping guide. I talk about places that have established campgrounds. That's one of my favorite things to tell people to do, especially if they're new to going to out winter camping. Plenty of established campgrounds remain open during the winter season. It's like 11 Mile State Park, which is one of my favorite places. And the first place I camped, it was during the winter. So an easy way to slide in there is go to a state campsite or an established campsite that remains open during the winter, because you'll still have some services. You may not have bathrooms, that some of them do. But you'll have the resources of that area that's established. And if you're on a state park, you'll have the rangers. So it takes down the fear maybe a little bit, and the risk versus consequences come down a little bit when you have more help there.
Okay. I love that idea. You know, and I'm thinking about a recent story about Camp Hale, this move to make it a historic site. And for folks that aren't familiar, it's this military training base near Leadville where soldiers basically learn to, like, not only survive in freezing temps, but fight. And I think about, I mean, camping's got to be an essential part of that. What do you think about the legacy of Camp Hale?
Camp Hale is really interesting. And you know, it's near Leadville. And anybody who spends any time in Leadville has probably seen something related to it before it became a monument. And we're pretty stoked that that's the case. I was in Alaska because I've always known about Camp Hale kind of like peripherally. But when I was in Alaska, one of my campmates, she is really into the history of Camp Hale. And so she told us about it before it became a monument. So she explained how some of those soldiers trained to scale like the Dolomites, I think it was, because they were fighting Italy. And so they did it at night. So they were mountain climbing and rock climbing at night to do like a surprise attack or kind of sneak up on them. So like, if you're going to train in a place to do that, Leadville's a great place. And so the legacy of those soldiers, I'm glad it's a monument. And I'm glad Leadville gets kind of like some of that love.
So you mentioned this trip to Alaska and you camped on a glacier in Alaska, right?
Yeah, that's what we did.
Yeah, no big deal. Just camping on a glacier. Patricia, tell me about what it's like to camp on a glacier.
It's nothing like what Colorado has, I'll tell you that much. Alaska has, if I recall correctly, our instructor said they're the last glaciers that are still growing. And so Alaska, and you know, the mountains over there are a little bit younger. Like as you go west, they get younger, but they're huge. And Alaska's huge itself. The glaciers in Alaska take up huge swaths of land. But also Alaska itself, a lot of it is not developed. And that's so amazing, just how big it is. And when I went there, I went for a NOLS course on mountaineering because I wanted to get more winter camping skills and mountaineering skills. So we had to fly into Anchorage, which is great. I had never flown that long before and still be in America. Like I was
totally.
Yeah, I was like, this is still the United States. And so I flew to Anchorage and then we went to Palmer where the NOLS school is in Alaska. Then we had to drive another hour to an air flight area, like an airport, what do they call it, landing pad, ran by Mike Meekin, who's like a rail renowned bush plane driver. And then we had to fly a bush plane like three at a time, 45 minutes into over the Chugach Mountains and into the glacier. And so it's pretty far in there. Like you can't hike in there. The only way out would have been to get Mike to come back to get us.
So part of the work that you do is also you take folks out and teach camping and outdoor basics. Is cold weather camping going to be part of your curriculum?
Yeah, it will be for sure. We're opening a new Blackpackers camp or school next year. We're finally doing that. And we're going to teach a woofer and woofa, wilderness first response and wilderness first aid. I'll become a provider of those at Blackpackers. We're going to teach backpacking skills, camping skills, leave no trace, of course. And then also some skills about being in the outdoor industry. Like I always say, it's one of the top three economic drivers in Colorado. So getting people involved in that's great. And over the winter, I do plan to show people like what winter camping looks like. When I got back from Alaska, so many people were just amazed that I was warm. I was comfortable. And I'd love to share that with other people so that they know this isn't as big of a deal as you think it is. This is as big as more clothing and gloves and paying a bit more attention, right? Of course, but it's not a glacier. We're not going to be on a glacier in Colorado.
So what would be, I don't know, maybe three tips you have for folks that maybe are experienced with camping but have not done winter camping yet?
Yeah, I always tell people you don't need to buy a four-season tent. A three-season tent with the right layers and the right sleeping bag will be just fine. If you're going to be going out there in inclement weather, don't, especially if you're brand new. And in those cases, you would need a four-season tent. But I would recommend people starting out to go out there when it's snowing. That's fine, probably not a blizzard or high wind. But a three-season tent will be fine. And that's what people take typically out in summer. Doing jumping jacks before you get into your sleeping bag because you want to get in your sleeping bag warm. Sleeping bags do the best at keeping things warm as opposed to generating heat. So do some jumping bags. While you're in there, you kick your legs a little bit. I would squeeze my rear end cheeks and unsqueeze them just to get some heat from like the muscle movement. I sleep with a hood on. Sleeping with gloves won't harm you. Sleeping with shoes or socks are great. I've told people you can double sleeping bags, but you need to have one that's incredibly big to put the second one in, because when you can press sleeping bags, it actually takes away its warmth and its warming power. There's a thousand things like making yourself some hot tea at night, putting in a thermos, putting that in your tent, waking up, you'll have some hot tea to get you going. The kind of things like that. It's not as hard as you think. It's just, it takes a lot more preparation and you have to think a few steps ahead when you're winter camping, as opposed to when you're summer camping and say you forget anything. You could forget your sleeping bag and survive summer camping most times, right? Like that's not going to happen in winter. So don't let that be the case.
I love this point of disconnecting or whatever. And I wonder, like, how does that feel? And I would be terrified. Like, oh, I can't Google.
Yeah, the first couple of days I was like, yo, I wonder what's going on Twitter. But like you get over it because you're also busy and you have to give everything your full attention. Like if when I'm making knots, I have to make well-dressed knots. Those knots are what's going to hold me if I fall into something. I do think that having those kind of breaks where you're reminded of life outside of it, because it seems like we like to think that social media has made the world smaller by giving us so much access to it. And I think that it's not the case. I think it's made it so big that can cause a lot of anxiety. And then when you go to Alaska and you're in this small perimeter with people and you're in this area that looks as big as you can ever have ever seen, it's actually much smaller there. And that's a different version of like connecting that, you know, social media does its way, but this is a different way. So I, as you know me, I'm on both.
Well, Patricia Cameron, thank you so much.
Anytime, Bree. It's always good to talk to you. Looking forward to next month.
You just heard an excerpt from CityCast Denver, the local Denver daily news podcast. Learn more about subscribing to the podcast at denver.citycast.fm or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Christian Garibay. Special thanks to Kiara Damari, Jack Armstrong, Claire Purnell, Alexis Kenyon, Shannon Young, and the CityCast Denver crew for their contributions to today's program. If you'd like to comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave us a voicemail at 303-447-9911. We'll play the messages back on Tuesdays during the Morning Magazine. Stay tuned for a commentary from Jim Hightower, and then Storytellers of Color with Rosanna Longo-Better. That's just after these news headlines from the BBC.